Do aging brains actually make more neurons?
Are medications that help stop smoking safe for your heart?
Can we determine that you're at risk for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in childhood?
And one of many reasons to be born in Hawaii rather than Mississippi.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. This is going to be posted on the 13th of April, 2018. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we have to turn to the massive one first, and this is one of yours. In the Journal of the American Medical Association, a state-by-state look at morbidity, illness, and mortality.
Elizabeth, as you said, this is a massive study, and it goes into great detail, looking at the state of U.S. health between 1990 and 2016, where it talks about the burden of diseases and injuries and risk factors among the U.S. states. I'll cover some major themes. First of all, between 1990 and 2016, overall death rates in the United States declined by about 22%. Unfortunately, in the last 2 years, those declines have actually been wiped out. In fact, there's been a slight increase, and that's because the leading causes of death over the last 20 years, including ischemic heart disease and cancer, which have gone down, have now been replaced, at least in middle age, by increased opioid or substance abuse, cirrhosis, and self-harm. Why be born in Hawaii instead of Mississippi? Across the U.S., there's a huge geographic difference in life expectancy. If you were born in Hawaii, your average life expectancy is about 81 and a half years. If you were born in Mississippi, the average life expectancy is about 74 and a half years.
And that's pretty remarkable. Of course, we've talked before about even county by county differences in mortality risk. And here in Baltimore, for example, if you live in one neighborhood in the city, you live on average 8 years longer than if you live in another neighborhood in the city. We've certainly been able to account for that with a lot of socio-demographic factors.
You're right. So they identified socioeconomic factors as one of the risk factors for mortality, but they also identified six risks that individually accounted for more than 5% of the risk attributed to what are called disability-adjusted life years, things that should not be unfamiliar to anybody. Tobacco consumption, a high body mass index, poor diet, alcohol and drug use, a high fasting sugar, and high blood pressure. These things are things that we actually have control over that can actually help bend that mortality curve.
Well, this is, of course, really good news for those who are actually listening to the health messages relative to these kinds of analyses, or any for that matter, since these are so common. One of the things I think I was rather chagrined by is the uptick in Alzheimer's disease as a cause of death.
You're absolutely right. It doesn't rank among the top three, but there's clearly an increased risk for Alzheimer's-related mortality. As you know, the incidence is increasing. Sometimes that's because other causes of death are now less prevalent, but they're also a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, some of which is cardiovascular disease. Some of the diseases we've talked about, hypertension and diabetes, contribute to dementia. And then obviously there are genetic things we're still trying to identify.
As we've talked about before, of course, the utility of studies like this one are that they help inform policy.
Bingo. That's the major thing. We can look on a state-by-state basis and say, okay, what are the leading causes of mortality for this particular region, and how do we address that? Major causes of disability, for example, things like low back pain and depressive disorders, aren't the leading causes of death, but they still rob people of having a healthy life.
What a great message. We probably could have spent the entire podcast this week talking about that particular one. But let's turn to one of the other studies. That's in a journal we've never talked about before called Cell Stem Cell. This was a look, and I picked this one because I'm a nerd and I freely admit that. It was looking at neurons and gosh, do we actually continue to generate new neurons as we age? And I'll recall for folks that just about 2 months ago, there was another study that was in the journal Nature that said, oops, sorry, I know you'd like to think that you keep on making new neurons, but in fact, you don't. This one takes a look at the brains of people who died suddenly of all ages, admittedly just a few, and found that, in fact, there are neurons in a part of the brain that's called the hippocampus that continue to develop even as people age. But there are other things that do slow down, and that's new blood vessel formation and what's called neuroplasticity. Are we making new tracks where neurons communicate one with another?
And as you suggest, Elizabeth, this is a fairly small study, an autopsy study, in 28 men and women between the ages of 14 to 79. And by the way, none of these individuals had any type of neurologic disease or any type of dementia. And they look for early neurons. Some would call them neuronal stem cells. There are thousands of them in the hippocampus. They may be there, but they may not be doing the proper things to make all the right connections and growing correctly. Now, this is encouraging to me. It suggests that we don't need to put new stem cells. We just need to encourage stem cells that are already there to regenerate neurons that are dying.
Okay, let's turn to your other one. This is taking a look at, wow, if we want to eliminate one of these risk factors that contributes to mortality and morbidity, cigarette smoking, how safe for our heart are common anti-smoking medications? This is in JAMA Internal Medicine.
Evidence has shown that quitting cigarette smoking is the single most important step that an individual can take to protect and enhance their cardiovascular health. Now, the current recommendations suggest that we do that in two ways. One is to use behavioral therapy. The second is to use available pharmacotherapy that is proven to be effective, and that includes nicotine replacement therapy and medicines such as bupropion and varenicline. There's been some concern that actually in individuals with known heart disease, ingestion of these medications can actually increase the risk of having a heart attack. And what this study suggests is that's not the case at all, that in fact, all three of these agents are safe. And that was proven in the study of over 8,000 individuals that were randomized to one of these three therapies, and they initially looked to see whether they had any adverse effects with regard to neurologic outcomes or to psychiatric outcomes. But they extended this study for a full year to see whether there were any bad cardiovascular outcomes. And what they determined was, even in individuals with known or suspected heart disease, the risk of having a heart attack or a stroke or dying of heart disease while on these medications or even in the weeks after them is really very small, and there's no difference between these medications and placebo.
Let's fit this in then to a comprehensive strategy for people to stop smoking traditional combusting cigarettes.
All right, so what that involves is, first of all, the physicians need to address it with the individual and stress the importance of it, make sure they refer the individuals to appropriate counseling or cognitive behavioral therapy that can help, and also find one of the medications, one of these three medications that the individual can take, nicotine replacement therapy, bupropion, or varenicline, that can help cigarette smoking cessation and is effective in at least a third of individuals when those principles are applied.
And I would add to that, of course, that we've discussed almost ad nauseum the fact that electronic cigarettes are probably not very helpful with regard to this effort.
Bingo. Although it was hoped that they could help people stop cigarette smoking, there's no evidence to suggest that.
Finally, let's turn to The Lancet, a study taking a look at the antecedents of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease in childhood. This is, of course, really interesting because this JAMA study, again, to refer back to the first one we talked about, identifies COPD as moving up as the third leading cause of death in this domestic cohort that was studied. In this group, they took a look at folks in Tasmania. It's a very long-term study. They looked at them when they were only 7 years of age and up until 53 years of age. They had data from about 2,500 folks where they were able to assess lung functions when they were 7 years old and at 53 years. The upshot of the whole thing is they said, we can identify three what they call trajectories to the ultimate development of COPD in three quarters of the people. Some of the factors that they suggest they could be modified include reducing maternal smoking, encouraging immunization, personally not smoking, and asthma control. Some of those are modifiable, but some of them, I don't know. I mean, they might just be biological.
When they looked at the risk factors for what caused people to develop emphysema or COPD, there are some individuals that don't personally smoke but still develop COPD. So the risk factors they identified were, first of all, some manifestation of allergy. That's usually asthma, allergic rhinitis, or skin manifestations, eczema. And so it suggests that poor control of asthma in childhood affects adult lung function. That's number one. So that's controllable. The second is maternal smoking during childhood. That's certainly controllable as well. And then finally, the development of bronchitis and pneumonia. And that's why they suggest immunizations can help control that. So all of those things are controllable. Now, what they also said was, even for those people that are predisposed, if you throw self-cigarette smoking on there, you're really multiplying those effects. So all of those things are controllable. The one thing that wasn't was a parental history of asthma. That suggests there's some genetic predisposition as well.
I don't think we have to say a thing about cigarette smoking, and I would also point to two studies that are in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week that also talk about this issue of asthma control. I guess what I meant when I said, I wonder how much of this is modifiable is I'm not sure we can modify somebody's biological risk for asthma or allergy.
There are some things we can do, decreasing pollutants and known exposure to allergens. But you're right in that once a person has been identified to have asthma, especially as a child, what we probably need to do is make sure it's properly treated.
Okay. I'm going to talk about the mortality data in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.